We've had a go for auto sequence start. The SRB hydraulic power units have started. T-minus 21 seconds, and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal is now underway. T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff, and it has cleared the tower.
Surgeon Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling.
The station with the happy difference.
Hey, this is Tom Metzger, General Tommy, in the Heartland and in the bunker. Ready for another big shoe here today, like your last state. Yeah.
Quiet, numbskull.
I'm broadcasting.
Yeah, quiet, numbskull. I'm broadcasting here. Well, yeah, Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in sunny Southern California. Cool last night. Probably not as cool as where you're at, but by Southern California standards, it was cool. My furnace even kicked on last night. Can you believe that? In a place where there's palm trees all around, my furnace kicked on. Well, I see the prince got himself a hot babe. He got himself a hot babe, a half Negro, just like his mother was playing around with a half towel head or something before she died. Well, that royal family's getting to be quite up with the times. Won't be too many generations till they have a Negro in the as king or queen. How about that? Let's tune in for a couple of minutes here and see what the big debate is on cryptocurrency and see what's going on there with Kaiser.
Could have bought a nice $750,000 house in San Jose. Now you could buy a $10 million. Dollar mansion in San Jose. You'd be a fool to buy anything, and I'm hearing people refer to them now as not cryptocurrencies, but cryptocurrencies because they intend holding them until they die. That is not money.
Max, you're biting your tongue. Go ahead.
Well, what Steve misses is the timeline we're talking about here and the replacement of fiat money by cryptocurrencies and the time it takes for this to happen. It's true that the price has been compounding at about 1% per day, but we're entering into a period of transition where fiat money is being effectively replaced with cryptocurrency, and we will start to see some of the things that Steve doesn't like about cryptocurrency, like the volatility, start to even out when the price gets closer to $100,000 per coin. At that point, you're going to see less volatility. You'll see fiat money being put aside and cryptocurrency embraced. It's already the number 25 biggest reserve currency in the world, Bitcoin. It's heading into the top 10. It'll soon be the biggest crypto reserve currency in the world. You've got sovereign wealth funds like Abu Dhabi now buying Bitcoin. You've got Russia and China now and Japan actively buying Bitcoin because they see that the fiat bubble is bursting. And again, the U.S. dollar is collapsing against Bitcoin. This is a paradigm shift. Steve is an economist, and he admittedly says he knows nothing about cryptocurrency. He's not a technologist, and he doesn't have any background in trading. So I can understand why Joseph Stiglitz came out today practically crying, big fat tears. He said, oh, my God, the government's not involved in Bitcoin. How will we survive? Well, Joe Stiglitz, get out of the way. You're an old guy with old views. They're no longer relevant, and this is a new paradigm. This is the new economy, and Steve King, quite frankly, is not even qualified to talk on the subject.
Do you know, Max, I wish Steve could hear that. And sad to say, I think we've lost the link with Steve's, but we'll continue. I'll try and challenge you a bit. I want to pick up on
something. He's running away in fear because he knows I'm dead right.
and it's a total paradigm is shattered, and he's probably out there licking his wounds already.
Well, Max, I'm going to defend.
Up against an online PhD economist. They can't hold a candle.
I'm going to defend Steve's argument, Max. He said a few moments ago that, you know, you talked about store of value or the fact it's usable. Isn't there a really strong argument there that it's being used speculatively as a store of value? But actually, where can you actually use your Bitcoin? There's not too many places, is it? Come on, that you can actually spend it. And isn't there a danger when people realize that they'll panic and sell their store of value?
Well, I think it's not so much
well,
as
I'll sorry, Steve. I'm just asking Max.
Okay.
Good to have you back, by the way.
Well, to answer the question, there are hundreds of thousands of transactions now a day, hundreds of thousands of merchants accept Bitcoin. The real estate market is being upended by Bitcoin. You can buy high-end properties with Bitcoin, yachts and properties and things of this nature, trickling down into the middle classes. But again, the timeline here has to be considered. The travel from being a store of value to a means of exchange is going to take another few years, and the price will get up to that $100,000 per coin level, and then it'll be much more useful as a means of exchange. The scaling that's going into it now is being implemented as we speak. The scaling debate is still raging, and these things are being resolved. It's only 7 or 8 years old, and it, again, it's number 25 in the world reserve currency. It's moving up to number 10. Okay, this is the new paradigm. Those who are arguing against it would argue against the printing press when Gutenberg first introduced it. They would argue against the airplane when it, Wright Brothers first introduced it. You cannot fight the fact that this is more efficient, it's a greater store of value, it's great for transactions, and it's putting the fiat money world out of business. The Jamie Dimons, the Lloyd Blankfeins are going to be dead.
Okay, Max, let's give Steve a chance to respond. And I just want to ask you, preempting what you say, Steve, Max makes the point this is the future, it's new technology, and decentralized, that's the key. That's what people want. They don't want bail-ins, they don't want governments stealing their money when they're short on cash. Isn't this the future, and isn't what, more importantly, what people want?
That's potentially what's going to happen with these cryptocurrencies. They are something which bypasses the need for a so-called trusted third party, when, of course, nobody trusts the banks anymore. And that was the original motivation for forming Bitcoin. But my point is that it can't combine the answer yes to two questions simultaneously. It can't keep on appreciating, I guess, and be used for transactions, because even though you can buy all those things with it, you'd be an idiot to buy those things now, because if you wait 10 weeks, you can buy twice as many or three times as many. So its price has to stabilize. Now, my worry is when it stabilizes, what will happen to that price? I don't think it's going to necessarily reach the stratosphere at $100,000 and then stay there. If you get to the stage where the only returns you're getting out of Bitcoin mining are the transactions, then I think the price has to fall dramatically. And, of course, there are other elements being added to it, things like the Lightning Network are turning up inside there, so there's plenty of developments to come. But I simply don't believe that it is, at the moment, two things. It is one thing, and that is a store of value. It is, you'd be an idiot to use it for transactions right now, and I hope Max agrees with me on that front.
Well, we already know that Max is going to be buying a yacht. He said you can. That's one of the things you can buy. I just want to stay with you, Steve, just because Max spoke a lot in your absence when we lost the line. And I just want to ask you about what's happening in Russia.
Yeah.
We've heard members of the Russian Central Bank, I think it was the deputy governor, saying they're going to try and block people from buying Bitcoin on websites. But at the same time, they're starting to push the crypto ruble. So are these the same things or different, what's happening?
They're different. I mean, the whole idea of blockchain is a really innovative piece of technology. You can actually have blockchains which are actually live contracts that are executing as programs inside part of the blockchain. You have things like Ethereum, which I'm not an expert in any of these cryptocurrencies, by the way, but I'm looking at the technology and understanding why people have brought them in. So something like a cryptocurrency may turn up. I know the Bank of England is looking at a cryptocurrency where it would create crypto bank accounts for everybody in England, which I would see as quite a positive development. So there's all these sorts of things. You know, I'm quite in favor of the aeroplane, Max. I've caught a few.
Let's come back to Max. He wants to answer on this. And I just want to know, Max, are the governments trying to copy Bitcoin here? What's happening?
Well, first of all, I am an expert in this field because I invented in 1996 the virtual specialist patented virtual currency and trading of virtual securities, and which sold eventually to Cantor Fitzgerald for many, many, many millions of dollars. I'm considered to be one of the foremost experts in this field. So I am an expert. When Stephen was offline and he came back, he made the mistaken assumption that this would be crazy for anyone to use it in transactions. He didn't hear when I was talking about the fact that this is a process. It takes a number of years. It will stabilize at a much higher price, I think at $100,000 per coin, and that's per the protocol. So for somebody who doesn't understand the technology, admittedly, as Steve had said, there are many dimensions to the protocol that it gives it the lifespan to go to battle with the fiat money system, using as one of its weapons the game theory that's inherited in this protocol, the Nash equilibrium that is distributed in the various aspects of the technology, whether it's the SHA-256 hashing algorithm, the rate at which the coins are diminished for the rewards, the rate at which the coins are taken offline, et cetera. That's all part of the original
genius. We haven't got much time left, and I want to squeeze in a couple of quick questions if I can. So if we can keep your answers brief, it would be great. And Max, I want to ask you, you know, the transaction times, they're getting slower and slower, and we're now seeing these split-offs. We've got Bitcash, Bitgold. Does that not suggest that Bitcoin's struggling if they're having to do spin-offs that work better?
Well, Neil, first of all, to get back to my point, this is a process where the transactions or means of exchange are coming in later at a higher price, but there are off-chain solutions right now that can be done. There's another cryptocurrency called Dash that does instant transactions. There are five or six big cryptocurrencies along with Bitcoin that make up this market to do battle with the $5 trillion per day fiat money U.S. dollar forex market that's imploding in real time. Once again, the U.S. dollar is engaged in a hyperinflationary collapse against Bitcoin at this moment.
And Steve, you know, there were some people who think this is great, I need to invest, but we have to be wary that this could crash, couldn't it? What are the dangers for investors at this point?
Well, there are two functions for Bitcoin. One is a dramatically increasing store of value. The other is using it for transactions. With the increase in value, it's got an enormous increase in energy consumption. I believe the amount of energy used right now to mine Bitcoin is roughly the energy consumption of Ireland. So there's all sorts of things which have to be reduced in the case of Bitcoin. And I think the energy consumption is drastically reduced and you just make money out of the transactions. I can't see this high price being maintained. I can see it stabilizing, but whether it can stabilize at $100,000 once it's used specifically for transactions and not for appreciation, I don't think that's feasible. I could be wrong. I'm not saying I'm an expert on this area, as I told Max beforehand, but the combination of massive appreciation and you'd be totally unwise to use it in transactions right now because of the amount of your value you're losing given its rate of appreciation. And once the rate of appreciation stops, what's the value? I believe it could be well below what it is now.
Okay, and I just want to quickly come back to you, Max, for the final word. And I also want to touch upon what I said previously. We're getting these spin-offs, Bitcash, Bitgold. Blockchain's the real beauty, isn't it, behind Bitcoin, the technology. Is there a danger we'll see another cryptocurrency coming in using the same technology that will be better?
Not really, because Bitcoin is unique. And to answer two questions at the same time, you have gold as a case study. Gold is used, takes a lot of energy to produce gold. Gold is used as a means of exchange as well as a store of value. It's been around for quite some time. Bitcoin is gold 2.0. It does the same function of gold. It takes a lot of energy to create a Bitcoin, that's true, just like it takes energy to create gold, but the unique attributes of gold being number 79 on the periodic table and everything that comes with that makes it, according to Isaac Newton and Aristotle, the perfect form of money. The way that the SHA-256 protocol, the proof of work, and everything that's involved in the Bitcoin protocol makes it the perfect cryptocurrency. That is why it's taking over the way it is. There are several others out there that do similar things that are also doing well, but we also have silver, we also have bronze, we also have Medigliani's, we also have other collectibles, we also have other stores of value. It doesn't discredit the fact that Bitcoin is still the mother load, it's still taking over the global finance in this way, it's putting fiat money out of business, and the bankers on Wall Street are running scared. Jamie Dimon is literally, you know, peeing in his pants at this point because he knows he's going to be out of a job in 5 years. We don't need the Jamie Dimons of the world ripping us off. We don't need Wells Fargo stealing money out of accounts. We don't need HSBC funding drug lords in Mexico to the tune of billions of dollars. We don't need those bad actors in society. And Bitcoin gets rid of all those financial terrorists. And it's about time somebody stood up and did battle because the government's not doing it. The academics aren't doing it. So we have Bitcoin to do it.
Okay, and given that was such a beautiful but quite lengthy oration, I'll give the final word to you, Steve. What would you want to say to people about Bitcoin?
The rate at which it's growing right now simply can't be sustained for two reasons. That rate of appreciation is like the old chessboard. You go from one grain of rice to two to three to two to four to eight to 16. That can't be maintained. So the rate of increase has to drop. And secondly, the energy consumptions are so enormous that if we continue the energy consumption, it'll be banned because of its impact on carbon, the level of carbon in the atmosphere. If it doesn't continue, then I think its price should fall.
Okay, it's been a great debate, a wonderful conversation. I hope people have gleaned.
Well, boys and girls, I was on the periphery of a lot of this stuff, but I didn't really have the money to play around with it. And I don't think any working person today can dabble around in Bitcoin. It's just too much money. If you didn't get in right at the beginning and then dump it once it started to go, I think that's where your mistake was made. Now, I studied years ago these pyramid schemes, and I've been in a couple of them, Amway for one, and I think there was another one, but I never made my fortune. However, my half-sister did make quite a bit of money in Amway, but that technically they say is not a pyramid scheme. But also I studied the intricacies of the South Sea bubble and the collapse that caused back in the old days, and also the great tulip mania that people got to investing in tulip bulbs from Holland, and that went way up and then collapsed. I personally am very conservative when it comes to money, mainly because I don't have much. But I watch this kind of stuff, and it's an interesting debate. I tend to think, too, when it reaches $100,000 a coin, something's got to happen. And it's not going to happen to benefit the working class, I don't think. Anyhow, it's up to you. You think about it. I play it. You think about it. Incidentally, that information came from a paperback book that's about 3.5 inches thick on the tulip mania and the South Sea bubble and all that kind of stuff. It's all the crazy stuff that's happened economically down through the ages. It's a good book. It's a hard read, though. Well, the Labour Party over there in Great Britain, or is it great? It's just Britain now, I think. They're being accused of ignoring their members' anti-Jew posts. I guess their website for the Labour Party is getting overrun with anti-Jew posts. Labour councillor Adam Langdon complained no action has been taken. So evidently the hierarchy of the Labour Party are not unhappy with this anti-Jew information. It sounds like we might have a better home in the Labour Party than the Conservatives, that's for sure. But I don't want to promote any party per se, but that's an interesting turn of events. I see here in the news where Iranian, they call him a hero, a judo expert, lost his match to avoid facing Israelis. The Iranians tell their people, don't do anything to promote the Israelis. Don't even look at them. So evidently, in his fight in the ring, he had to face the Israelis. So he quit and forfeited. I would say that's just a little bit extreme. Well, now we go in this day and age from the Red Scare to the Sex Scare. I see a co-host NBC's Today, Matt Lauer, once gave a colleague a sex toy as a present. It included an explicit note about he wanted to use it on her, which left her mortified. On another day, he summoned a different female employee, to his office and dropped his pants, showing her his penis. Ha, ha, ha. After the employee declined to do anything, visibly shaken, he reprimanded her for not engaging in a sexual act. He would sometimes quiz female producers about who they'd slept with, offering to trade names, and he loved to engage in a crass quiz game with men and women in the office. Fuck, marry, or kill, whatever that means, in which he would identify the female co-host that he'd most like to sleep with. These accounts of Lore's behavior at NBC are the result of a 2-month investigation by Variety, with dozens of interviews with current and former staffers. Variety has talked to 3 women who identify themselves as victims of sexual harassment by Lauer. And I wonder if that big nigger on there got into this, the act. Maybe had a threesome or something. Yeah, maybe so. You know who I mean, Al Roker. I want to see some stuff on Al Roker. I want some real hot stuff. Dig back into the records about Martin Luther King's partying down there in Atlanta in the hotel, which I was privy to through a third party telling me about it. I guess he's too much of an icon to go after poor old Martin Luther King, the second coming of Jesus. Matt Lauer was making $25 million a year. Can you imagine that? Risking all that just to play games? $25 million bucks. I wonder if Dave Garraway, the one that began it all with the Today Show, I wonder if he got into that stuff. You know, he had a chimpanzee on the set all the time. What was his name? I forget. We used to watch it every morning on a black and white 12-inch TV. All I can say is these guys must be eating Viagra sandwiches or something. Maybe they're suffering from the small penis syndrome. Maybe that's it. I remember in a movie way back, one of the best comedies I've ever seen, and that's a Wild Wild World, was it? No, that wasn't the exact name, but in the movie, Terry Thomas, if you remember the British actor, had a couple of teeth out in the front, funny as hell, Terry Thomas. He's riding in a Jeep, I think it was, with, I forget that old gal who used to be in the movies and everything, but anyhow, Ethel Merman, yeah, and he's arguing with her, and he said, you know, you Americans, no, that's not a British accent. You Americans, if the brassiere straps ever broke, the whole economy would fall. Something like that. That was one of the funniest lines in the movie. He was referring to it. They're obsessed with tits. If the straps ever broke, the whole economy would fall. It's going to be interesting how long this sexapade stuff's going to last. I mean, you know, this could bring down the government, could bring down the Congress, the Senate. They haven't even scratched the surface yet. I think if I were Trump and they'd start that stuff up again, I'd say, hell yes, I did, and I'm glad of it. I'm thrilled. What do you want to know? That's the kind of answer they don't know how to handle. Like this Bible-beating, more Christian fanatic down there in Alabama. He's not going to give up the ghost. He's not going to throw in the towel. It's causing the hierarchy of the Republican Party to go crazy. If you want to know who are the most wild sex nuts in Hollywood or any place else, right now, just watch the ones that are real quiet. The ones that are not talking. They're the ones to watch. Well, all the Negroes around who are anybody are surrounding John Conyers of Detroit. That old reprobate nigger. Yeah, he's in there just because a bunch of ghetto people voted for him and they keep him in there. But now they're trying to tag the sex thing on him, and you and I are both sure that he did, but he's standing tall with all his black buddies surrounding him. You got to give him credit. White guys fold like a cheap accordion. Some of these black guys stand real tall. His buddy says the allegations against Congressman John Conyers are very disturbing, and I'm aware he has emphatically denied them, Claiborne says. That's Senator Congressman Claiborne from down south. The House Ethics Committee should conduct a prompt, deliberate, and thorough investigation. It's going to be interesting. You can imagine how many of these black politicians were in propositioning white women working in their office. You can imagine that over the years, and how many of them accepted it. Well, the old Islamic State is still out there promoting a forthcoming sequel to its most infamous movie that threatens America at the beginning of the Caliphate, with the new trailers showing fire raining down on several U.S. cities before America is engulfed in a fireball. ISIS official Al Hayat Media Foundation didn't give a release date for Flames of War 2 until the final hour, unquote, but distributed the trailer extensively across many open media platforms, including YouTube and Google Drive. The teaser begins with a rapid-fire montage of fiery battle scenes that appear to be from Iraq or Syria. The focus then shifts to the United States, with columns of fire raining down on Los Angeles, Florida, New York, Texas, Nevada, labeled on a U.S. map. ISIS appeared to be referring to the San Bernardino Christmas party attack in 2015. The 2015 attempted attack at a Draw Muhammad event in Garland, Texas. The 2016 Orlando nightclub attack, this Halloween Manhattan bike path attack, and the Las Vegas mass shooting at the beginning of October. The terror group continues to claim gunman Stephen Paddock as their own, Abu Abdul Bar al-Amraki, yet have not released evidence to back up this claim. Oh, wow. But they have not released evidence to back up the claim. Authorities have maintained that they have discovered no terrorist links, as the motive remains elusive. Wow. Well, I had to take a little break there. I lost my Siberian Husky for a little while. We looked high and low for her, and I couldn't believe it that she got out. But anyhow, she had wormed her way under a bed in the bedroom. She's about 2.5 feet tall, but she got under that bed somehow, and that's the last place we looked. So anyhow, we've had a panic situation here at the bunker.
In some people's minds, then so be it. But what CNN did was not fair to that alleged victim. You just can't cut in and out of people's lives. You just can't cut in and out of people's lives. This is a real life situation dealing with real life people. Look at you all. Look at you all. Don't come that close to me. You're outside of my client's home because you want a story. But the media wants to try and convict him and not let him get his rebuttal out. He says he's not done anything wrong, but he's accused of victim bashing when he says that. When I say he hasn't done anything wrong, I'm accused of victim bashing. He has the right to defend himself. He has the right to vehemently defend himself, which he is against these allegations. And if that's victim bashing in some people's minds, then so be it. But what CNN did was not fair to that alleged victim. She had a right to hear her entire voice heard. She has a right
to have her claim out there just as well as he had a right to do a rebuttal. What they need to do is run fair and accurate stories, because she has a story to tell too. And the reason it's important is this, is because it's just that, a story. She says that Mr. Conyers sexually assaulted her in the car. She was so upset about it that she didn't quit. She was so upset about it that she became a live-in nanny here. What victim of sexual assault becomes a live-in nanny in somebody's home? Who does that? She says now that the FBI is lying. The FBI has a document saying that, and she brought this to CNN, that she didn't want to prosecute. She says she didn't tell the FBI that. The FBI said something different. But they cut that story, and they ran directly to Matthew Lauer's unfortunate situation. If you're going to report it, get it correct, you're dealing with people's lives. And obviously, you're interested in this because you're standing here in front of my client's home. And I know you have a job to do. Okay? So after I get done talking to you, I'm going to respectfully ask you to leave my client's home. Your client comes out tomorrow. Not at this juncture. I wouldn't recommend that at all, sir.
Would you think anybody talk to you?
I wouldn't recommend he talk to you at all.
I hope you got that all. Sort of broke it up there. That's the attorney for John Conyers, Mr. Black, in front of his house. Incidentally, the lawyer has a bow tie on. You know what that signifies? Maybe not, but usually it's the black Muslims. So maybe he's got a black Muslim attorney. But that is odd that the gal didn't leave his employ, just making the charge, and she became a nanny and stayed in his house after this supposed rape. That's weird. That is very strange. Of course, sometimes people do some very strange things. Like my dog crawling into a space that I don't see how anybody could get in there. And he's hiding under the bed. Ah! And he's not a little teeny dog. He's a pretty big dog. Now, here's a hilarious one. Al Franken lecturing on women's rights and so forth from his congressional seat. How about that?
It was free of charge, right? So, yes, there's a provision in there that requires, I think HRSA determines preventive services, and then those are part of the essential health benefits in the ACA, if I understand the framework correctly.
Are you aware that HHS commissioned the Institute of Medicine, an independent, nonpartisan organization of highly respected experts on health and medicine, to review what preventative services are necessary for women's health and well-being? And then on that basis, the Institute of Medicine recommended coverage for all FDA-approved birth control methods free of charge.
I believe that's the case, yes.
Do you agree with the Institute of Medicine's conclusion that access to free birth control is vital to women's health and well-being?
So, Senator, separate from the issue of any birth control or which one should be covered, one of the principles that we have around thinking about the access to insurance is that it ought to be insurance that the individual wants to acquire and the level of coverage that they want. So if I have concerns, my concerns are actually at a much more precedent level, not about this coverage, this drug, that product, this one or the other, but rather should there be flexibility for the individual to choose the type of insurance package they want? No animus towards any particular type of preventive service. It's more that there ought to be, our system ought to enable flexibility in there that does not exist with the current framework.
But you agree that the Institute of Medicine's conclusion that free birth control is vital to women's health and well-being?
I couldn't speak. I haven't studied the IOM report. Obviously, we at HHS have very important programs through Title X and otherwise to provide family planning assistance and services.
Do you agree with the Institute of Medicine's conclusion that access to contraception free of charge reduces unintended pregnancy, which in turn reduces frequency of abortions?
I haven't studied it. It seems to make some sense, as you stated.
Okay. Do you agree with the Institute of Medicine's conclusion, and just this is their conclusion, that reducing unintended pregnancy also reduces the health risks associated with such pregnancies, and that contraception helps women to increase the length of time between births, which reduces maternal mortality and pregnancy-related complications?
I think we all share the goal that unintended pregnancies, especially by teens, is something we want to work to prevent, and we want to work to educate, and we want to use our programs to support that.
In light of this, do you agree with the Trump administration's actions to undermine the access to birth control?
So on that issue, that is a balance between the essential health benefit and the conscience of the organizations involved. As I mentioned earlier, I think it was close to only 200 organizations, whereas the actual Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act implementation there around the contraception mandate actually even excluded tens of millions of people who were in grandfathered plans. This conscience exception has...
I run that for you as an example of the absolute hypocrisy and corruption at every level of our government. Not our government, the corporate's government. Now here's a guy who's being charged with sexual deviancy or whatever, getting right back up on the podium, interrogating another legislator in the White House. And that guy could probably be a child molester or something too. Huh. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, at least he could have taken a few days off. No, I'm going to get right back up there and pretend it didn't happen. Well, that's, you got to hand it to those Jews. They're good at that. Where the airline business is recruiting more and more non-whites. And I remember when Dennis Mahan told me that out there at American Airlines in Oklahoma that they had these Arabs working on the flight line and putting their prayer towel down by the flight line saying their prayers to that war criminal that they worship. Anyhow, as more and more of this stuff happens, a lot of people are not going to understand and recognize it has a lot to do with race. American Airlines is rushing to ensure thousands of December flights aren't affected by a scheduling error that left the nation's largest carrier without enough pilots assigned to work during the busy holiday. Oh, as many as 15,000 flights between December 17th and the end of the year could be affected by the issue. According to the Allied Pilots Association, a union representing more than 15,000 American pilots, many are non-whites. America did not confirm the number put forward by the union or issue its own estimate on the number of affected flights. Quote, "We are working diligently to address the issue of fucking up people working in our company, and many of them are non-white. Now, to avoid cancellations this holiday season," the Fort Worth-based company said in a statement, "we will work with the APA to take care of our pilots and ensure that we get our customers where they need to go over the holidays." See, this is gradually taking place, like we've said for decades. It's sort of gradually taking place. Now that there's more and more non-whites in these sensitive spots, and even now, even their kids are growing up to be in these spots. You're going to see more and more and more corruption, and the system is not going to work well. And you're going to say, oh, why is that? I can't figure that out. We need a congressional investigation. Well, ultimately, it'll end up being a Zimbabwe airline type thing. In Zimbabwe, that's the bottom. But we're not there yet. Of course, it's going to take us a few decades to get there. But we'll get there, and then people will say, I wonder why that happened. Can't be anything to do with the race. No, can't have anything to do with dumbing down the schools and putting every anthropoid that can walk in the schools and passing them through and intimidating other students. Couldn't be that. Couldn't be that. No. American Airlines said it has reserve pilots to help cover the affected flights, and the company is offering to pay pilots 150% of their hourly rate to pick up certain open trips. Well, maybe that's the way it was planned. The issue arose from a glitch in America's scheduling system. Well, there's a human behind every glitch that allows pilots to take time off by dropping assigned flights, even when there wasn't another crew member available to cover for them. Typically, these requests would be denied if adequate staffing isn't available. Well, you dig deep, you'll find some asshole screwed with a computer, and other assholes just follow whatever the computer said. This is a funny one. Quote, this is a potential crisis that we see well in advance, unquote. Sure. Captain Dennis Tager, T-A-G-J-E-R, that don't sound like an Anglo-Saxon name to me, a spokesman for the union, told the Associated Press. This is very unusual. Yeah, the pilots' union has filed a grievance over Americans' proposed solution. The corruptions both in the labor movement and the corporation, the news agency reported, alleging that it violates the employees' labor contract by not including union input and improperly restricting premium pay. The issue affects flights in about a dozen airports, including DFW International Airport, as well as airports in Boston, Miami, Charlotte, Philadelphia, New York, and Salt Lake City. The company operates about 6,700 flights per day. Well, happy Christmas. It's going to be fun getting on a plane, American Airlines. I've always told you, don't fly American. It's a dangerous airline to fly. If you do, just think in your mind the view of all these Muslim workers on the flight line getting out there on the tarmac with their prayer towels. Just keep that picture in your mind as you get on the plane. But what do I know? I'm only a white racist separatist. We don't know anything, do we? Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. It's a little short, but I can't take any more excitement today. My heart's about to attack me. I'm going to have a toddy and sit down. I'll close out with a little crosstalk from Russia Today. How about that? See what they've got to say.
Big tobacco targeted people with mental illness. In fact, they gave free
mental
cigarettes.
Ill-
the world according to Trump. I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in New York. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London Metropolitan University and author of the book Bombs for Peace. In Miami, we have Ty Berry. He is the Washington, D.C. coordinator for the woman-led peace and social justice movement, Code Pink. And in Berkeley, we have John Walsh. He is a scientist, peace activist, and author of numerous anti-war publications. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. John, let me go to you first, because you got up earliest for this program. I much appreciate it. If we look at the campaign trail, we look at candidate Trump, and we look at his foreign policy 11 months in here, first of all, there's a great discrepancy. But is there any coherence to his foreign policy, irrespective of what he ran on from the time he was inaugurated to now? Do you see a Trumpian vision out there? Go ahead, John.
That is a really difficult question because, as you noted, there are powerful forces against the vision that he articulated, such as it was during the campaign. And I think maybe it's good to go back to that for a second because I'm especially interested in how American progressives are reacting to his clearly what were themes of peace. And can we go back to that for just a second? In the campaign, Donald Trump said in the primaries, where he was confronting a rather hawkish base, he wanted to get along with Russia. Progressives dismiss that as so much talk. But if you think about it, why would he say that to an audience that would not like the message? The only thing that would do, and the only thing it did do, was lose him votes. So he wasn't saying it out of opportunism. So that was genuine. The idea of especially getting along with Russia, a simple way to say it, but really, do you need to say much more, was genuine. Mm-hmm. And other things were genuine, too, that progressives should have applauded, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right, right.
Which progressives had been working against for years and years.
Right.
He dumped that on the first day, and there was a silence. No one said, hey, that's good, maybe we can work together. Actually, Bernie Sanders did.
Okay,
very quickly,
let me go to George now in New York here. But George, on almost everything else, I'm glad that John mentioned those things here. I brought my own little short list here. Pretty much stayed the course in the Middle East, add the tragedy of Yemen in there, which is, you know, a disgrace to humanity. And everyone involved in it should be ashamed of themselves. It's awful what's going on there. Afghanistan stayed the course. Okay, he did leave the Iran nuclear deal, or in the process. The only thing Barack Obama did right in foreign policy, as far as I can tell. Arming Ukraine. Syria is a mixed bag. North Korea, of course, the tensions we have there, which is a lot more complicated than the mainstream media want to talk about. And, of course, as John has pointed out, U.S.-Russia relations are dead in the water. Go ahead, George.
Yes, that's absolutely right. By and large, he hasn't affected any serious change in U.S. foreign policy. But there are indications that he would like to affect some kind of a serious change. I mean, despite all of the criticisms that he has come under for his supposed friendliness toward Russia, even though there's no evidence for it, and despite the fact that he's facing a serious prospect of impeachment over his supposed traitorous attitude toward Russia, he has maintained a friendly stance toward Russia. He didn't need to meet with Putin in Da Nang. He did meet with him. And then he didn't need to talk to the press and tell them that he thinks that relations with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. So he took a considerable political risk in doing that, and that would indicate to me that he is interested in improving relations with Russia. So it's a kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
We don't yet know how things will evolve. I mean, you can take a more optimistic view that this is still the first year of a Trump administration, and that he may decide to go his own way in the second and third years and actually go with his instinct, which I think is to improve relations with Russia.
You just said, Jordan, let me go to Ty in Miami. You just said go his own way. I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it. You know, Ty, the thing is that it's not that if Trump wants to go his own way or not, is it if he's going to be allowed to. Because I think this is what I look at, is not necessarily policy, but the institutional barriers that are in front of him. This is what he faces more than anything else. Personally, I think he would like to rebuild America. I believe all that stuff he had to say, infrastructure, stuff like that, okay? And I think so, it's something he understands. Foreign policy, well, when he was had the Lebanese prime minister right next to him and he started criticizing Hezbollah, I mean, everybody kind of broke out in laughter. Hezbollah is part of the government, okay? Well, what about, Ty, the institutional obstacles that, you know, that are in the way of any kind of Trumpian worldview? Go ahead, Ty.
Well, first, we came into this Trump presidency thinking he would be an isolationist and he would take us out of foreign wars. And the fact is that he's guiding us deeper and deeper in Barack Obama's war, as you stated rightly, Peter, this shameful, horrific, human rights violating catastrophe that's going on in Yemen. But what I see is I see Trump, the big businessman, and I see that his idea of foreign policy is tweeting, name-calling, and arming to the teeth these oligarchs in Saudi Arabia and causing havoc. There's now 2,000 soldiers, U.S. soldiers, we found out, in Syria. These are the Trump administration is all over the place. They don't have a foreign policy. The only foreign policy is coming from generals. and generals in his cabinet are the ones that are holding him back. They're the ones who are actually the sane ones in the room, is supposedly. But I think that Trump, the idea of Trump going, becoming more friendly with Russia is a great idea. We want to have friends around the world. But we can't do it when you've got a media that's so controlled and it's so headstrong on their idea of deciding what our foreign policy should be. Foreign policy should come from our governments. We should have more control in Congress over this out-of-control president. We see more of, we see him denouncing the Iran agreement, which is a great foreign policy, one of the best things Barack Obama did, getting us into this, pulling out of Cuba over this so-called hoax of ear infection.
Yeah, sonic thing,
It's ridiculous.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just a joke.
You know, John, you know, one of the things that came up was a story last week, you know, when apparently the president of the United States was speaking to the Turkish president, and he said that the U.S. wouldn't be sponsoring Kurds in the north of Syria. And then you come from the State Department, the Pentagon, they say, well, they hadn't heard anything about it. This is what I'm getting at, is that he may have ideas, but it doesn't go much further than the Oval Office, it seems like. Go ahead, John.
Well, first of all, anybody who thought that that Trump's presidency would bring peace to the world on every front was dreaming. That's not what he said. That's not what he promised, and that's not what we should expect. First of all, there is some progress in Syria. The Trump and Putin did arrange the ceasefire in southwest Syria. The situation there has improved dramatically. Now, there are forces against that, but that's there. Trump did meet twice with Putin, once in Hamburg and once in Southeast Asia, even though there was a lot of pressure not to do that. The atmospherics at those meetings were very good, even though there was pressure against all that. And the other thing we have to look at is President Xi. The atmospherics there are very good. I think, you know, to go back to the TPP, that was not just a bad economic deal. That was the economic part of the economic military confrontation with China. Trump got rid of it. And I think,
rightfully,
you know,
so.
You have to put, so I'm not looking for everything. And the problem is I have, you know, I would offer a very simple thing here. He's president now, and it's not an election. And I think that you have to do a very simple thing, that the policies and the things that he does that you oppose them.
Fine. I agree.
But the things that you think. But the things, if he does something you support, you should say so, because without that support, he won't be able to continue.
Okay,
that is a great sin of the progressive.
I agree. Gentlemen, I want to kind of push back a little bit what John had to say there. I don't think anybody on this panel or viewers think that the world was going to sing kumbaya, okay, with the election of Donald Trump. But what I was going to, I'm going on his words. Less interventionism. I mean, I would have been happy with that. Just less of it. All right. Go ahead.
Peter.
Go ahead, Ty. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to ask John. I mean, when you call the head of a government in North Korea little rocket man, and you provoke a nuclear-powered country, that is dangerous.
That is not a foreign policy.
That is lunacy.
You're changing the
no,
subject.
No, I'm just saying
That's
to you is that you're
do.
Talking
you're
about
not-
TPP. I'm just saying this is a very, very dangerous part of his foreign policy, if that's a policy at all. How are we going to deal with this if this heightens the tensions between the United States and North Korea, not South Korea and North Korea or China and North Korea, but the United States in particular and North Korea?
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit more
Can
about
I ask
North
a
Korea.
Hang on,
gentlemen. I'm going to go to a hard. Since we're considered, I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump's worldview. We seem to disagree, which is good. John, you wanted to react real quickly to something that Ty and George and myself had to say. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out, I made two points that I thought, or maybe three if you want to include TPP, where Trump had done well. Now, what was the response to that from, the response to that was, well, let's look at North Korea. I wasn't talking about North Korea. I'm not expecting a lot of North Korea, although I don't think there's going to be a war there because of the stance of Russia and China.
I want to ask this simple question.
Trump did something we would like in meeting with Putin and meeting with good atmospherics with Xi and even having some economic agreements. Did you see in any progressive publications, did you see any dispatches from the Code Pink or any of the progressive organizations praising with one word of praise for that?
I agree with you, John. I mean, the mainstream media is not going to say anything good about at all about Donald Trump, and that is.
I'm not talking about the mainstream media.
Well, that's what most people get their information from. George, one of the problems I have, and I'll be really honest with you, is I was willing to give the benefit of the doubt to this president until he attacked Syria, a gross violation of international law based on a fallacy now, in retrospect, if somebody had actually done some investigating, which nobody wants to do anymore. They are quick to draw judgments and point fingers here. That's when I just said, no, I'm going to push back. I didn't want Hillary Clinton. I'm still glad she wasn't president. But I made it very clear, if we see the same bad behavior, I'm going to call it out. And that was wrong. That is probably a war crime. Go ahead, George.
No, there's no question that that was a war crime. It was a violation of international law. It was an act of naked aggression. It wasn't done on any basis of any kind of serious investigation. He rushed into that bombing campaign without doing any kind of laying the groundwork or anything like that. And that's a terrible blot on the administration. However, it's interesting that he hasn't really followed up on that.
Yeah.
Many people who actually were cheering this on, all the mainstream media who are excited by this, expected him now to follow up on this and to launch some kind of a serious bombing campaign against Syria, a regime change operation of the kind that Obama didn't dare to venture against Assad. He didn't do that. And having done that bombing, he kind of has gone back to a much more reasonable policy on Syria, in which he's kind of wound down the CIA jihadi network. And from what we can gather from that conversation with Erdogan last week, he looks like he's going to wind down the cooperation with the Kurds. So it does look like his instinct during the campaign, which was to basically end the whole regime change operation in Syria, it does seem to be bearing fruit now.
Yeah.
So the good thing is that he didn't follow up on it in April.
I think there's a very interesting litmus test right before our eyes right now, and it's Ukraine. Ty, let me go to you, because, again, there are conflicting reports. Apparently, there is a debate going on inside the White House and the other agencies, the report to the executive branch. I think it's very interesting is that, you know, if lethal weapons are given to the Poroshenko regime, that conflict will heat up more, okay, after, what, almost 12,000 deaths that has been aggression coming from Kiev towards the Donbass here. If Trump somehow signs off on that, then again, it's the same perpetuation of a foreign policy we've seen for decades now. I always say on this program, it's the genetic code. It doesn't matter who's president. The same kind of aggression will continue to be repeated. Go ahead, Ty.
Well, we see that a part of Trump's foreign policy is to sell arms wherever anybody is willing to buy them.
Good point.
So we also have seen a uptick in the violence in eastern Ukraine. We're seeing aggression on both sides, I believe, but definitely coming from the what's called the Ukraine government at the moment. I believe that the Trump government, the reason it looks like they're hemming and hawing is because they're very covert. We don't know what they're doing, as opposed to Obama being a little bit more open. But in getting back to Syria, I don't know where that's coming from. We just found out that there are more soldiers in U.S. soldiers in Syria. I think the U.S. is responsible for major war crimes. There were carpet bombing in Syria. The problem is we're not allowed to see what's going on in Syria. The United States puts a filter on any news that's yep. coming out about there. We just heard that there's 30% more civilian casualties, and that's from a New York Times article. We don't know the facts, but there are 30 times more civilians died in Syria and Iraq fighting ISIS than the United States.
Well,
you know, to
Ty, you should be.
I don't like these.
You should be thankful to RT because we do report those things, okay? I'm so proud of this network's coverage of Syria because it really blew off the lid of the pure nonsense that the mainstream was pumping out. It was a really disgraceful coverage of that conflict here. And I'd like to point out, since we're on the topic here, take a look at the mainstream media. You'll never hear that Russia played an instrumental role in defeating these terrorists, okay? You never hear that, ever hear that. You hear on Fox News, Trump is winning in Syria. No, it's Trump isn't winning in Syria.
That's
okay,
right, yeah.
It's others here. You know, John, go back to it's already been mentioned on this program already. It really does look like a general's foreign policy here. If you're in the Oval Office watching the president, or you're over at the Pentagon, because it seems that's they're given a lot more discretion. You know, I find that very troubling. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think that the remarks that your first guest made on Syria were excellent. Yes, there was that bombing, which the so-called progressives love to focus on, the one bombing of the airbase. But there's also been ceasefires, which have saved a lot of lives. And there's also been a cutoff of CIA funding to the anti-Assad jihadis. That you have to look at, too. So while you oppose one, I opposed that bombing. You've got to support the other.
Can you tell me where you get this information
from? Well, your guest just said it a few minutes ago.
Well, I can address that. It does appear that some of the operations have gone, gone lower in their intensity or even disappeared to some extent. However, we do know. Let me approach George here. I mean, what are those thousands, 2,000s, probably more American troops doing in Syria? There's no justification for it except we want to avoid ISIS 2.0. Well, you know what? It becomes a magnet for terrorists, okay? Haven't we learned that after 15 years of this nonsense? Okay, when you leave, intensity will go down. It's common sense. Go ahead, George.
Exactly. It makes absolutely no sense for the 2,000 there. I guess this is Mattis's policy, Defense Secretary Mattis's policy, that he will use this 2,000 troops
leverage.
Holding on to some of the oil fields. It's a leverage against Assad. But I don't think that it is sustainable, because with Turkey and Iraq on the Russian side and want to pursue the Astana peace process, how is he going to keep these 2,000 troops alive, body and soul, there? So, it's not a sustainable military operation.
You know, Ty, one of the things I find very disturbing, and it looks like it was Jared Kushner that was involved in this gambit with the Saudis after the events that played out vis-a-vis Lebanon. I find this really disturbing. We would all like to see peace in the Middle East. I think across the spectrum we'd like to see that. There's obviously some players, the more war, the better, and you know exactly who I'm talking about here. But again, is this a private operation with Jared and the Saudis? And apparently the State Department was in the dark about this. Again, I find this very troubling. That's why I keep asking, is there a Trumpian view of the world? Because we keep looking at separate issues. I'm asking, are there any dots to connect at all? Go ahead, Ty.
Yeah, I mean, Trump goes to Saudi Arabia, dances with the brutal despots, and now they feel emboldened. And they're talking about this phony war with Iran, you know, this... Iran is backing Hezbollah, which is rightfully defending Lebanon's border against terrorists from ISIS, and that supposedly Iran is getting involved in Lebanon. This is all about Israel. The fact that Jared Kushner is there and Trump has not come out and said one word about the building of new giant settlements in Palestine. Yeah. There's no push towards a Israel-Palestine peace agreement. And the Saudis are only instigating terrorism in Syria. We know that for a fact. I don't know why we can't talk about it. It seems like the third rail of politics now is not Israel, it's Saudi Arabia.
Okay,
Saudi Arabia
jump in here. Let me give John the last word here. Let me give John the last word. 25 seconds, my friend. Go ahead.
Well, I would say that the whole... The Achilles heel of Trump's wish to get along, as he says, with Russia has always been Iran. I don't think that's possible if he turns Iran into an enemy. But the basic problem there is that Trump's skull, like Capitol Hill, is Israeli-occupied territory. So that's the problem. That is the key problem, I think, right now in some sort of, as Stephen F. Cohen calls it, detente 2.0 with Russia. And I hope he gets to pursue it. Now, everything he does
We have a lot of differences here, but at the end of the program, I think we came to a lot of agreement, at least on one topic here. We've run out of time. Many thanks.
Now, some of you out there may think, what the hell is he running this kind of stuff for? He's been pushing this kind of stuff for quite a while. That's not what I'm used to hearing in the right wing. The right wing don't say this kind of stuff. They don't spend this kind of time on this kind of politics. That's because they don't understand or they don't care. And you've got to keep up on this stuff because it is important to the white race. It's extremely important to the white race, foreign affairs and so forth. So I'll see you tomorrow. Take it easy. And remember, if you don't listen, you'll have to feel.